Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Diana Dini. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Diana. Good talking to you again.
Yeah.
Been a little while, but hey, I thought of you when I got this note from Stefan. I sent you a copy of it. And for regular listeners of the show, Stefan sent a message that Kirk and I talked about in a previous episode. And it was about, he had a 25-year-old cell phone that was still working. And he didn't say it was connected to anything, but he said he got it out of an old box he had it stored in, and it worked.
You know, I saw a story about that with somebody. I was digging out through their junk drawer at home, cleaning it out, and found an old phone. And they're like, well, this is kind of ancient, but what would happen? And it booted right up. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Kirk and I talked about how durable most electronics is in a lot of devices we have. If you do due diligence, and in this particular one, it's related, I think you picked up on his message, though, is that when they first designed that phone years ago, it was a 7-year design, and they had no point of reference to what does it take to get a phone to last 7 years. So he admitted, he said, you know, we did a lot of good engineering and made it really robust and durable. And we just, if it was risky, we did the best engineering we could at, and they had time to do it. And then he said, then the life cycle's being reduced. And so we had, instead of 2 years to put it out, we had 6 months. And we see that in lots of industries.
Oh, so their development life cycle, they were expected to put something out faster?
Well, I've seen that in practice. But I think you could read it also as that the product's life cycle, instead of 7 years, and I think that happened with cell phones, it went to closer to a year. And whether it was fashion or the must-have new features, although the new 600 gigabit, you know, cameras don't really entice me a whole lot. It's like, I can't tell the difference between that and the one from last year. So it's the difference.
Yeah. That's how I was reading it too. That the target. Yeah. The target reduced.
Yeah. So the target life, but that often doesn't get communicated well. I've seen so many product requirements documents that it has a 2-year warranty because it's required in Europe, and it has very little information at all about how long we expect customers to use it. You know, if it was Kirk, then it is like 10, 15 years for a phone. He finally updated his phone. He had an iPhone 6 and he just got a used iPhone 15.
Oh, you know, I sound like Kirk because I needed a new phone at some point, and I went into the store. I didn't order it. I went into the store and they're like, wow, this is vintage. Like, yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Can you get me another one that'll work as long?
Yeah.
But I think you and Kirk are outliers in that regard. But I'm keeping my phones longer and stuff like that. I think at one point, though, was the cell phone industry, you know, got into it. It was every year if people were swapping these things out. And it was mostly driven by new features and just market share. We have to have something new on the market. Otherwise, they'll buy somebody else's and then we lose them as a customer. But I think part of it was, is that he said, I think what caught my attention anyway was, you know, as our development and our expected life cycle for the product in the field got shorter, we didn't have to do the good engineering, because making something that'll last a year is a whole lot different than something that'll last 10 years. And yeah, we were getting more information about how it was used and so on. So the way he phrased it is that we could just do a quick hack or do an add-on hack. And if there's an issue with emissions, put some tape on it, you know, some copper tape to ground it out or shield it. And as opposed to what's proper engineering is to design it out of the product rather than just put a Band-Aid on it. And I thought that was troubling.
Yeah. So you have to ask why is the target life cycle or target product life reducing? Is it really because we know that in a year we're going to be swapping out the camera and it's going to be, the old one's going to be obsolete. Do we want people to buy it more often? So we want them to break. That's something we talked about before in another episode. Or is it just the thought that, you know, if it doesn't have to last as long, it won't take us as long to develop, and the engineering costs won't be so high.
Yeah, we can use cheaper materials, less engineering time.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Or you know, if I was in that situation, I kind of wonder why. I don't know if I would get a straight answer. But knowing the purpose of why are we reducing the target life for this? Like, what are we really trying to accomplish with this? Well,
you can imagine that a director level or senior level person, you know, that has this banner on the wall, quality first or whatever slogan they use, is not going to go tell their engineers, just make it good enough.
Yeah, you know? I know. Right.
They don't want that in writing anywhere, right? If there's a major defect in this thing and it's, you know, major recall type situation, and here you are on record saying, well, we cheaped out on it on purpose because we don't want them to last too long. Whoops, we went a little too far.
As I was saying, you'd like to know the root cause, like the thinking behind it, but you're probably not going to get the straight answer. No.
And the requirements documents I've run into over the years, we're going to have to do a 2-year warranty. And I said, why 2 years? And they said, well, the European Union for Consumer Products requires it to be 2 years. So we just do 2 years. Okay. Well, how long do you think customers are going to use it? Well, 2 years. And I don't think warranty and how long people use it are the same thing. You know, do you have a huge resell of products right at the end of warranty, however long it is? No. Then why do you expect that? And it's not listed. So I go talk to engineers and how long should this last? And I told the story many times I talked to two engineers and their manager, electrical engineers and their manager on an assessment once. And it was like, how long should your product last? 50,000 hours, MTBF. So try not to get on my soapbox, but they knew what the goal was.
Your trigger word.
Trigger word, yeah. And they said, so what does that mean for the design? Oh, it's very difficult. I got to gold plate everything, get most expensive things, does that and other thing. And it's really hard to achieve that goal. Okay. So, the goal and it affects your design decisions. The next person I asked her, what's the goal? 50,000 hours. Okay. What does that mean? Oh, I ignore it. It's so easy to achieve that. It's, you know, I use the cheapest parts. I just, you know, I don't have to think it through very hard. It's trivial. I'm like, huh, well, do you work on the same board that Ralph over here works on? Oh yeah, we're on the same team. Do you ever talk about how hard it is or easy it is to achieve the goal? No, no, we don't talk about that. Okay, now I'm concerned. So I go talk to their manager and she says 50,000 hours. And she says 50,000 hours. And I say, so what does that mean? And she goes, I totally ignore it because we don't know how to test it. We're not going to measure it. So who cares? Like, there is no misalignment there.
Hey, that's what I was thinking all along. I'm like, does it have to do with the test setup and the test requirements? That's a problem about aligning your team on what it is you're developing.
And I think what you're picking up on is that it's that the logic behind it, and you see it sometimes in project management where they'll say we have time, we have money, and we have quality. No, it's time, resources, and there was a third part of that triangle, and I'm drawing a complete blank on it.
It was time, resources, and quality. So you can do it. You can do it fast and cheap, but it's not going to be good.
Right.
Or you can do it expensive and with high quality. And it'll cost you more.
Right. And so I see that in project management lingo where they'll say, this is the most important. And this is get as good as you can. The other one is you sacrifice. And they made it very explicit in the program. And it would, at the early stage where it's trying to get the concept of work the first time and everything else, it's let's use all the resources we can to get something that we can then refine and make into a product. And then the priorities shift. Now it's more cost. We got to, you know, strip out all the extraneous costs so that we have a profit margin. But early on, you're spending a lot of engineering time, cost, those resources to get it as good as you can early on. And then you shift priorities as you move through the life cycle of development. I've seen it done that way, but it's usually when I go ask, if cost is the most important thing, what does that mean to the engineers that are working under it? And it goes, well, I have to use the cheapest parts I can find that might work. And others are saying, well, you got to consider warranty. So I can't go with the cheapest parts because they'll cost us in the long run. And others are thinking of it as, well, it just means I can't spend engineering time on it because that costs them a lot of money too. And I, there wasn't that discussion beyond it saying, what is pay attention to cost mean and why?
Right. Yeah. And even switching gears mid-project, like what you're describing, it sounds to me like the project's going along, spending a lot of time on engineering and choices up front. But now they're starting to run out of money as they get to transfer to manufacturing. And so now you're hitting the budget for the project. So now you have to pay more attention to cost.
I don't think it was that. I didn't mean that way. I meant that at first we weren't buying components. We weren't assembling a bill of material with a concern about how much it costs that bill of material. It was more focus on, let's spend money on engineering to figure out what is in the bill of material. And then the engineering changes to focus on reducing the cost of the bill of materials, not the engineering cost. It's because the biggest cost to the product is going to be its bill of materials cost, all the components we put into this thing. And the engineering time is most of the time is insignificant to a mass-produced product's total cost. It's going to be orders of magnitude spending more money on components. And so if I can save a nickel on a set of components, it replicates into a large number really quick.
Yeah. Okay.
But if that's not clear, then the engineers are left to their own devices, which sometimes is a good thing.
Well, that's really funny that you said that two people are working on the same board and one was like, oh, this is, you know, it's really hard. And the other one's, oh, this is easy.
Yeah.
With the life cycle.
And they had very similar experiences and seemed, you know, both knew what they're talking about. And I said, when I heard the second one, I was like, do you guys talk about your component selections or recommendations? He goes, no, we partition the board up and we draft our piece, you know, designs, and we design review each other and do stuff like that. But we never talk about how long it's supposed to last. They both knew the goal, but the boss didn't care. It wasn't reinforcing it. So it was less than useful.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they weren't planning to test for it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I, that's not what she said. She said, we don't know how to test for it. I'm like, so that's an excuse just not to do it. And
yeah,
and so I had a different conversation with her. And she didn't want to. She said, and I've run into that with other teams where it was a quality department had these little tags all through the requirements document. So this product has to be less than 10 pounds or something like that. And there'd be a little quality, a Q and a Q number. And I'm like, what are these? I've never seen these before. And it goes, oh, that refers to the quality department saying that when we're all done with everything, they're going to weigh it. And if it's not 10 pounds or less, then they're going to veto it and say the design's not good. I says, well, that seems kind of backwards. Why don't they talk to you early on? It is that the right requirement, you know, for what you're doing? Like, yeah, we deal with that later. But there were dozens and dozens and dozens of these tags in there. And then they got to the reliability requirement. And they called it a objective. And they did not put a tag on it. And I asked, why isn't that tag? This is why I'm here and why you guys have realized that it's important. He says, but we don't know how to measure it. We don't know how to do this reliability testing stuff to to know if it will last for 10 years or not. So you just make it optional. You're smart people. Go learn something.
Well, and then, so that sounds like a case, and this is also typical, that you measure the things that are easy to measure.
Yep.
But maybe don't matter as much to your ultimate reliability requirements or your quality requirements.
Well, it's part of that misalignment, isn't it? It's the you know, the quality group wants to be able to weigh it or measure it, or what's its length, or is it consistent, and all those kinds of things. And some of those are vital, right? There's this critical to quality set of specs or required measurements and stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Yet I got this, and it created a behavior in the organization is that, well, we're not measuring it. It's optional. So I'm not going to pay attention to it. And the designer's going, well, I've got these 15 other things that I actually they're going to check. And if I don't get it right, we have to redo it. So I might as well get it right. Yet after a number of generations of products, their reliability was so poor that they were losing market share. And I was like,
that's why they called you in to talk to the team about what was happening.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Now we get the full picture. Yeah.
That's the only reason I knew about it. It's not because they were doing really good. They don't call me then.
Yeah, no one ever does.
Yeah. And so it was, okay, do you see the dynamic here? You got to break that. And so we spent a lot of time with the quality team and more of the engineers. Well, how do you actually measure this? How do you determine if this is going to work or not? And so it was a lot of reliability engineering training more than anything else, but it also was the coaching of, if you know that this is important to your customers, it's not optional. You can put whatever fancy tag on there you want. The final arbiter is going to be your customer. And that's what you're seeing, is they're going to your competitors, because yours is just not durable enough. And so I think there's another layer of that misalignment is, what does the customer really want versus what you articulate to your engineering team, and then what the engineering team actually understands and implements on.
Yes, it's all going to be linked up and aligned. Yeah, you should be. So in medical device world, they do a lot of trace matrices where they trace from customer needs to requirements to how it's going to be tested, and then what quality measures are going to be monitored for that. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy. It isn't easy to do, but it's so important to be able to match your product with your customers' expectations. Yep. And sometimes when you're working on those product lines that have just been around for years and the reliability is starting to drift because you just keep compounding the same decisions or indecision about how customer targeted experiences link up to what you're actually doing, it just makes it worse. And you sometimes have to go back and say, just stop. What are we doing? And what is our real target? And realign.
Yeah. And it takes a manager at some level, more senior level, to risk saying, we need to change this. And if they're wrong, they probably miss a cycle in the market, which is a career ender for many. So there's forces at work that prevent stepping back and going, what's going on? It's usually a disaster of some sort. You know, rapidly declining market share or major recall or getting purchased by another company, and they say, what in the world are you doing? You know, I've run into all of those circumstances. But it's an interesting part. It does take work. I think even at a high level, though, is that we expect our customers, some will use it for a year. Most will use it for 50,000 hours, to make a joke on myself about MTBF. And and some will use it for decades if they can't get away with it. And where are we trying to design to? Where is the heart of our financial trade-offs that we want to do, that's what we want to design for? Understanding what customer needs are versus what we can do versus what we're trading off with. And if that's not there, it's a bit chaotic. And that is sometimes creates great products, sometimes doesn't.
Yeah.
More times than not doesn't.
And it's not just engineering, it's a business decision.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I get that. I've run into that so many times is, well, how do you set a reliability goal? A senior project manager said, it's a business decision. I mean, we could create a printer that'll last 50 years, but we don't sell another printer. So we make it so it'll last long enough that the customer believes that it's a good brand, I'll buy that brand again. Okay.
Yeah. We've talked about that before too. That's another mm-hmm. mindset that's a reality, but frustrating.
Well, if I got a phone that only lasts 6 months, and I've had a phone that did that, I don't buy that brand anymore.
Yeah. You don't have to, because there's enough alternatives out there.
Yeah. And there's good ones out there. So, but anyway, interesting thought. And there is more in Stefan's message. So we got to come back and try take a look at some of his other stuff at another time.
Yeah, I think so. That was just a little bit.
Yeah. It only had five paragraphs, but it was fun.
Yeah, it's hard being an engineer and designing for reliability stuff, but it's also fun. But yeah, there's a lot of external interactions that you have to manage and be aligned with the rest of your team on.
Yeah, definitely. So if you suspect your organization's got a bit of misalignment there, that's the first step, is recognize it. And then go ask those embarrassing questions, going, what are we trying to do here? How does this relate to what's important to our customers and to our business? It'd be the way I would probably phrase it. And that will help me as an engineer make decisions. What do we focus on? What do we need to actually pay attention to? And help so you can recognize it. But if you have a story about where you did a turnaround, or I'm thinking into the listeners, is if you have a recognize the misalignment, or it saw it come into focus, or have a good process to keep the alignment going so that you're working on the right things, implementing the right things, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. You can find a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Diana and I and the other hosts are all available through LinkedIn, where we got this message, and on our about pages. Plenty of different ways to get in touch with us. And so it's a side conversation I'm having with Stefan, and it's like, these are worth diving into more. There's more to it. And Diana, you brought a couple of ideas I didn't even see in this that I thought, oh, we got to talk about that. So thanks.
Yeah, it's worth talking about with other practitioners.
I thought especially you were going to say AI.
No. Well, especially if you're in reliability and quality, having those connections to be able to bounce ideas off of, or to commiserate.
Yeah, if nothing else.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, we'll wrap this one up, and I look forward to more questions. And by the way, this year we've had, I think, more than 50% of our episodes, roughly, I haven't kept track in detail, have been by listener comments and questions that we pulled in.
So that's awesome.
It's I think that's great, and I appreciate it. And so keep it up. We look forward to your comments and questions. And thanks so much, Diana. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Later.
Yep. Cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.